guys, in all cases, as far as what's going on in the early stages, it's adding power or voltage in a linear manner. Then your log IF takes a logarithmic measurement of that and displays it on the screen as some number. It might be dB, 10 dB per kilo, 10 dB per centimeter on the actual screen. And there's another slightly more complicated factor going on within the log IF, the way it behaves on noise versus the way it behaves on CW. There's about a 2 dB change in the way the log IF behaves. We're not going there, but the basic noise floor of your analyzer, you'll see it move down as you go to more narrow filters, and depending on the signal you're listening to, the two noise powers, the noise power of your analyzer and the noise power of the signal coming in, they add in a particular manner that I tried to just describe. Over to you, Joe, to B2LYY, K2IW, wait for the beeps.
Quebec Golf Zulu. So it sounds like unless the signal coming in, the unintentional signal coming in, unless it's very, very strong, it's not going to necessarily bother that much a very narrow band signal system within the confinements of that first extraneous signal. That sounds like what you're telling me, because of the looking at the bandwidth that you're looking at across, that you're much, much narrower than the initial the initial interfering signal. Sounds like it's not going to bother it that much. Basically, what the question was, what I was trying to get at.
Yeah, Bill has made quite a few of these kinds of measurements in the business that he's in. So, Bill, tell us what you've experienced along the lines of what Joe seems to be asking. WA2 or WB2, I think it was QGZ. K2I, W, go ahead, Bill.
Okay, so this is a seat-of-the-pants personal experience thing with a FM two-way radio at either 18 or 25 kilohertz IF bandwidth. And what happens in T-band with these TV stations out of that are normally out of the area, like there's one down in Virginia, Chesapeake or Norfolk or something or other that comes up here every once in a while, and it pretty much decimates two-way in that band. And here's the way: if you want to make a quantitative measurement of exactly how much, exactly what the noise level is, I mean, I would probably make a channel power power measurement. What do you want to call it? Receive total wideband power between two. You know, I can set markers for a bandwidth, and I would look at whatever that noise power is in that 25 kilohertz bandwidth of a narrowband two-way IF strip. But you can look at it this way, right? You have 25 kilohertz worth of IF bandwidth, and whatever that signal is coming from out of town, now your normal noise floor in there, if you look at it spectrally, is going to be something like a minus 120, minus 123. You have that big signal coming from out of town, now it's a minus 90 or a minus 87. What happens is with your desired signal on channel, your narrowband FM transmission, it looks like a worse signal to noise, right? So this other thing fills up the whole IF. You have your, if you look at just CW, center of that 25 kilohertz bandwidth, what you have is an overall crappier signal to noise, and it's like having a noisy signal from the user's perspective with the narrowband FM transmitter, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. I do understand that. That's sort of what I was asking, but it's going to be at a certain definitive level when the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
25 kilohertz of bandwidth or 12.5 or whatever the user is using, eventually it's going to get to a point where it's not going to bother anymore. But sometimes when the propagation gets to be to a certain level, yeah, I guess the stuff would kill you. That's what I'm sort of getting at. If you measured across all 6 megahertz and let's see what the noise power is coming through in from a receiving antenna, and then I guess look at that at a narrower bandwidth, if there was a direct relationship, it seemed like that there is. As you just start looking at narrower and narrower, the level of noise you see going is lower and lower, but still may be higher than what's desired for the noise floor of the receiver, the intended noise floor of the receiver itself, for the user. So I do understand what you're talking about, Bill.
You've got it, Bill, if you want to add anything to either Joe or your statement.
that's about it. If they, I mean, if you really wanted to know what the noise level was, you make that channel power measurement based on the 25 kilohertz bandwidth or whatever, and that's the power that's actually in the IF of your radio. If that's near or a little bit below, you know, no impact noise, but what it's going to be is an overall signal-to-noise degradation with how it raises the noise through the entire IF bandwidth. The higher it gets, obviously, your narrowband signal stays fixed, and your signal-to-noise just decreases. So, that story, and like that, WE2QGZ.
You had the case on a number of situations, Bill, where, say, for instance, somebody's television inline preamplifier built in the year one, sitting up in the attic of a house, breaks into oscillation. The oscillation happens to be on one of the channels that your cell phone system is operating on. It raises your noise power, therefore all the signals you want to listen to have a decreased signal to noise ratio. You get more dropouts, and until you do some fox hunting and search down that signal and eliminate it, you've now got a noisy channel or two of your system, which gives lower performance. You've actually experienced that kind of a situation, haven't you, Bill? WV2QGZ, K2RIW.
Yes, I have. So here's the only thing, right, and depending on the technology, right, so any of your, if you want to call them 3G technologies, UMTS or GSM or CDMA, any narrowband emitter in the my received bandwidth, which for CDMA is a meg and a quarter, for UMTS is about 4 megahertz, 3.84 megahertz, you know, all of that stuff, that will definitely impact me in a bad way. The good news is, for a narrowband emitter in LTE is made up of a whole bunch of I want to say something like 128 or 200 kilohertz wide subcarriers. So as the LTE, you go from 5 megahertz to 10 to 20, you're just adding more resource blocks, as they're kind of referred to, or subcarriers. So a narrowband emitter in LTE only beats up one subcarrier or two subcarriers, and the system's smart enough to say, hey, you know what, I'm not going to use those. I'll just avoid them and put my traffic elsewhere. So that's a little self-healing. If you have a wideband emitter in there, it does the same thing. It just beats everybody up. And probably the bulk of all of this noise stuff is a broadband noise. A couple of the TV, oscillating TV amps and stuff like that will be narrowband emitters. I have a thing over in Queens now. It's about a minus 64, but it's only about, a couple of kilohertz wide.
From what you just described, Bill, it sounds like the LTE has some of the characteristics of a kind of protocol or transmissions called MIMO, multiple input, multiple output. You've got multiple subcarriers. There's a degree of redundancy or coherence between those subcarriers, so that if a narrow band external emitter starts wiping out one of those subcarriers, the remaining subcarriers, there's enough information for the receiver to reconstruct, is what it sounded like you're saying. So it has some of the characteristics of MIMO, multiple input, multiple output. Am I wrong in making that guess about LTE, Bill? WB2QGZ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, from like a multipath smear or something, there may be some. It may do something like that. What this really does, though, is, in other words, the LTE overhead or controller, the device that's controlling where everybody goes, in other words, what how many subcarriers you're assigned and all that other stuff, says, you know what, I have bad luck in resource block or subcarrier number 221. I'm going to stop using it. Right? In other words, so it's not that it's able to reassemble stuff through error correction in adjacent or other spaced subcarriers. It's simply the system saying, this subcarrier has a bad signal to noise whenever I try to use it, so I'm just going to stop using it for a narrowband emitter. And MIMO typically refers to, for example, most guys, I guess, these days are running 2X MIMO, which means I have two data streams out of the transmitter and two data streams out of the handset I use opposite polarities, orthogonal to each other mechanically in the antennas. And I have one data stream, plus 45 slant, one data stream minus 45 slant. And the handset is able to do two of those as well. You can do up to, right now a lot of people have 4x2 MIMO, four data streams out of the transmitter. So I actually have essentially four transmitters up in the sector, each able to do its own data stream, and two times MIMO back from the radio. Shortly, we're going to have four times MIMO back from the radios as that ability is implemented. I think the Samsung Galaxy X7, S7, I mean, and S7 Edge, and the highly flammable S7 Note are capable of being flashed for four paths back to the cell.
The so-called cell phone system is getting more and more elaborate. The so-called fifth generation proposal and fifth generation, my guess is that some of the more progressive companies are starting to tool up, starting to install hardware, getting ready for fifth generation, in which they want as much as 10,000 times more equivalent bandwidth, more data rate for fifth generation, so that tremendous amounts of data can be downloaded to your handheld device. I wonder, have you seen hardware being added already built with reference to fifth generation? WV2QGZ, K2IW.
Yeah, like a lot of things, I don't think that the standards entity has actually fully defined 3G, let alone 4G yet. So 5G is equally in the mind of the beholder. It's sort of a concept, it's sort of a general idea for throughput. Nothing deployed on the street now. The place I work for has a proof of concept cooking, and it was demoed, I think, to the commission last week. The manufacturer that's working with us has a proof of concept or a demo they're running in Europe. And it's really just one set of, one cluster of radios around a campus, because it's all millimeter wave stuff. It's all very broadband stuff, very, very wide bandwidth stuff. We use sort of a pre-version of that. It's really running 40 or 50 hertz bandwidth of LTE in 50-some-odd gigahertz. And I'm able to push, 500 megabits through that and online a site. And I think that's like the simple, non-cellular one-path version of what the 5G is looking at,
The highest frequency being used for the carriers of the hardware you're familiar with right now, Bill, did I hear you say 50 gigahertz? When it comes to the huge bandwidth required for what they think fifth generation is going to become, they're saying the only place we can get enough bandwidth to do all this is at 20 gigs, 40 gigs, 60 gigs, and so on, millimeter wave type material. So a lot of development of the transmitting hardware and receiving hardware are going to be required to do that. So of the equipment your company is using right now, what is the highest frequency they use over the air? Are they getting into millimeter waves, either experimentally or for some of the data channels or whatever? Over to you, Bill, K2IW.
Okay, well, not sure where the actual 5G proof of concept is actually running in frequency, but it's probably 26, 28, 32, 38 gigs, something like that. We do have a bunch of backhaul, in other words, cell back to switch or a cluster coming back to a fiber location where a bunch of cells are fed in a some sort of hub and spoke or something, using bands up to 38 gigahertz. I have on the island a couple of 23 and 18 gig paths, which are also for backhaul.
The actual antenna doing transmitting and receiving at those microwave and millimeter wave frequencies, SHF and EHF frequencies, what do those antennas actually look like, Bill? I presume they're pretty high on the tower, I'm guessing it could be a horn-like antenna, but here I'm not sure. So what do those antennas look like, Bill? And do they have a line-driving preamplifier on them and the down converter right at the antenna? Do we meet your QGZ, K2RIW?
W2QGZ. Yeah, everything, all the active stuff is up top, so I have just a piece of, 50-ohm LMR 400 style, half-inch flexible plastic cable as my IF cable, my baseband cable up to the antenna, and everything else is done up top. We do have a couple, I think these wideband LTE radios run in the vicinity of 47 to 52 gigahertz, so we have one or two of those we use for temporary service restoration or a temporary site. If I'm going to run a cow or something, I can microwave over to it. But for the most part, the dishes we use for backhaul, they're actually dishes. Relatively high, high tolerance reflectors, typically a sort of solid material, especially on the higher frequency units, kind of a something you do on a lathe type piece of steel versus a pressed out piece of aluminum.
And the dish antennas being used at that frequency, Bill, are these prime fed parabolic dishes, or is it offset fed parabolic dish, somewhat like the KU band TV downlink? So is it an offset fed dish, Bill? And is the dish, say, 18 inches in diameter? QGZ, K2RIW.
So, they're mostly prime focus. The ones that I've actually looked at are taken apart. Some of them have radomes over them. Judging by the ones, even some of the ones with radomes, they're definitely not offsets, I'll put it that way. Some of them are fed through a hole in the center of the dish with some kind of, radiating, some sort of feed that comes out, waveguide to something in the center. Some of them actually have I've seen some of the supported subreflector in the center, where you feed it from the back and then you have a subreflector in the center with four supports. I've used it in a different life some 47, 48 gigahertz equipment like that.
Yeah, that subreflector type is kind of a cassegrain, and is a there's something called a cutler feed where you've got a piece of waveguide that goes into a kind of a splasher which feeds the signal backwards back down the outside of the waveguide to light up the dish. So and some of them have a button hook, as it's called. In other words, the waveguide comes around into a question mark like situation in order to direct the signal back to the prime fed parabolic dish. Lots and lots of kinds of antennas. Good stuff. I think this RF is going to catch on now, Bill and Joe. We're going to go on to Jonathan now, KC2SHO. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Jonathan, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. I'll keep it short. I got my son here with me, but hope I'm not beating a dead horse. I've been trying to maybe alert some people, and hopefully it's not falling on deaf ears. The audio input, I believe the issue is the audio input to the IRLP node is clipping and very distorted. Very difficult for us connecting over IRLP to hear much of what's going on at all. It takes a lot of effort to try to hear what's going on. That's all I wanted to say. I hope somebody can correct that. And I appreciate the net, as always, everything you guys do, all the hard work. We miss hearing you guys loud and clear down here. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, the tone that people are hearing is something that Eric, KE2EJ, our technical maven, is working on. The linking between the repeaters has this tone. Also, the audio that gets from the 2585 repeater down to the IRLP and also the 975-375, the audio is kind of ratty sounding. I'm listening to myself now on 375, and there's a lot of, it's not pleasant sounding audio, heavily clipped, and quite a bit of extra noise in there. Again, Eric is working on that, so there will be improvement as I see in the future, Jonathan. Good that you're bringing it to our attention, and it's something that's being worked on, so hang in there. I think another week or two, it's going to be improved, it says here. There's an awful lot of equipment on Long Island at all of those sites being maintained, and a rather small staff of people doing it. I make jokes from time to time telling Eric, okay, his vast committee of people helping him do maintenance, he can assign them to various locations at various times. In many cases, it's all one human being doing this, and he's got a day job in the broadcast industry. So hang in there, Jonathan. I think it's going to get better. Okay.
K-E-2-E-J.
Okay. Well, now we're going to get the information from the horse's mouth. Go right ahead, Eric. K-E-2-E-J. Tell us anything you want to. K-2-R-I-W.
K-2-R-I-W-K-2-J. Yeah. I know what the problem is, and it's a little bit of a feedback loop that's going on in the system. I just haven't had the opportunity to get out there and deal with it, so hopefully I'll get to it sometime this week and it'll all get taken care of. K2RAWK2J.
Very well, Eric. Doing a good job. We're going to double your salary. And good luck with that operation. So it's going to get better, Jonathan. Hang in there. Now it's time we go over to the mailbag, KC2WGB. Well, we're glad to have you back, and you're going to give us more than the usual number of submittals tonight, because we got some catching up to do. And I think I've even told John to choose one or two of the questions that are sometimes misworded. Quite often, you can tell by the way a person asks a question. He only has partial understanding of what he is asking. And so sometimes there's a lot of hidden information in a misworded question that can be helpful to all of us. It can be educational if we discuss it. KC2WGB, K2RIW. You've got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, everyone. All right. Yeah, we got a few questions tonight. Let me go to the first one. I'll let it drop and ask this question. Interesting question. Okay, Dick, directional couplers. That's what this gentleman's working with. And he realizes that, let's say we had a directional coupler that's rated at 1 gigahertz, or 800 megahertz to 1 gig. His question is, if he puts two of them in series, we know that if we use a single coupler below its rated frequency, it'll work, but the attenuation of, let's say, a 10 dB port would not give you an accurate reading as it's rated for that particular frequency area that it's designed for. But his question is, if he were to take two identical directional couplers, put them in series, okay, and it's rated for 800 to 1 gig individually, would that give him a rating of accurate 10 dB attenuation at 400 meg to 500 meg?
Okay, he's got a pair of directional couplers in series. In other words, the main straight-through line of one goes to the main straight-through line of the other. And each one of these is a 10 decibel coupler. In other words, there's a third port coming out of each coupler that has a coupling coefficient 10 dB down. So now he's got these two couplers in series, and he's got these two coupled ports. He's got the port number 3 of the first coupler and port number 3 of the second coupler. And what is he going to do with those two ports? Is he combining them in some kind of a way? There's a lot of missing information there, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW. How is he, what is he doing with the coupled ports on the two couplers?
Okay, with the him in series, he's using half of the rated frequency, and he's only monitoring the third port on the final output, the final stage coupler. And he wants to know if that will maintain the accuracy of the 10 dB to get the third port on the first coupler. We're only dealing with the third port on the second coupler.
Now I understand. He's only using one of the couple ports. The answer is absolutely not. The second coupler downrange doesn't even know the first coupler is there. The way a directional coupler works, the straight-through line usually carries 90, 95, 98, 99% of the energy. That goes roaring right through the directional coupler. Alongside of that straight-through line, there is the so-called coupled line. In other words, internally, if you took it apart for a short distance, the internal mechanism looks like open wire line, looks like twin lead. There's two separate center conductors side by side with a particular spacing between the two. Therefore, the second line, which has a termination on one end and the third output port on the other end, that second parallel line samples a little bit of the energy coming out of the main straight-through line. And so, energy-wise, the thing obeys conservation of energy. If you add the power going straight through and you add the power coming out of the directional coupled line, those two powers usually add together and come up with unity. It doesn't waste any power, per se. Now, the magic of a directional coupler, the well-kept secret that very few magazines will tell you or very few textbooks will tell you, is the frequency region that you really are allowed to use. Let me drop. If I pick up a directional coupler, I'm not talking about a TEM coaxial type directional coupler. I'm not talking about the waveguide kind. So as long as your directional coupler doesn't have any waveguide to it, it has a frequency region that's huge compared to what's marked on the cover. It may say on the cover 800 to 1,000 megs. That's the region over which it is well calibrated, and maybe it only has a tenth of a dB of ripple, and so it's called a 10 dB coupler, and it may go from 9.9 to 10.0 across that frequency region for its coupling coefficient on that third port. It's sampling a little bit of the power, 9.9 and 10 dB down in my example. However, if you now go to lower frequencies, you now use the coupler at 500 megs, 100 megs, 50 megs, 10 megs, 5 megs, and I'm serious, it goes all the way down to zero. And throughout almost all of that frequency region, it's falling off almost exactly 6 dB per octave as you go down in frequency. Let me drop. If I took that 10 dB coupler, which its center frequency is 900 megs, and if I used it at 90 megs instead of 900, I'll have to go through the mathematics of this, but I think it might be something like a 22 dB coupler. We can calculate that. But its coupling coefficient goes to a much weaker coupling coefficient. Instead of minus 10 dB, it's going to be minus 22 in my example at a much lower frequency. But it is very mathematically predictable. So in other words, it's a beautiful device, even though it's rated 800 to 1,000. If you decide to use it at 90 megahertz instead of 900, it's going to give you an extremely predictable device, a predictable performance. In most cases, it still gives you the very high directivity. In other words, it favors the signal in one direction compared to the other direction by at least 20 dB. So, it's a beautiful device, and if there are guys who will be at a flea market, let me drop. They want to be able to sample the power coming out of their high power 2-meter transmitter or the 6-meter transmitter. And the only thing they can find at the flea market is a directional coupler rated at 1 gig or rated at 10 gigs. And he says to himself, gee, I'm looking for a directional coupler at 144 or at 50 megs. Well, he's looking at it. It's on that table. Even though the label says 1 gig or 10 gigs, it has a very predictable performance down at lower frequencies. And so it falls off, if you plot the voltage versus frequency, it falls off like a sine function. In other words, the sine of 90 degrees would be where it is at its rated frequency. At half the frequency, it's a sine of 45 degrees. So, in other words, you take the decibels, the 20 dB log decibels of the sine function, you convert your frequency regen, frequency ratio that you want to use, into a fraction of 0 to 90 degrees. If I'm at half frequency, I use 45 degrees. If I'm at one-tenth the frequency, I use 9 degrees, if you know what I mean. So the exact voltage that comes out of it is very predictable. There's ways you can calibrate it to be double darn sure, but directional couplers go all the way down to DC. Let me drop. And they keep their directivity all the way. Now, the directional coupler also has a predictable form performance when you go above the rated frequency. However, it loses its directivity. So you can use it much higher, much lower in frequency, and you get a kind of predictable performance, but you lose directivity. So going lower in frequency than what's marked on the label, if you know what you're doing, works like a charm. And there are times at a flea market you can buy a device like this for $5 and $10, even though the brand new price was $3,000, if you know what I mean. Nodder is a very popular brand name, for instance. There's a lot of other popular brand names. But putting two of them in series, the second one doesn't know the first one is there. They're thoroughly independent events on that straight-through line. I wonder if that is close to what you think the person is asking for, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, you've answered this question. I can see how he came up with the question, thinking about it in the losses, and like you say, that second coupler doesn't realize that's just a straight through. It's like a piece of coax going to it, and he would be able to measure approximately the same attenuation on both of those ports for that specific frequency. Yes, I love playing with these directional couplers. I have about 50 of them, and I've done a lot of fooling around with them. And by the way, when you go above the frequency, the error that's produced, is that due to the capacitance of the device?
The answer in general, John, is no. The way the coupled line behaves, the two lines that lie side by side inside of the directional coupler, one is the straight through line where 90 some odd percent of the power goes through, the other parallel line samples some of that power. The two lines side by side are a kind of twin lead, but it's an unbalanced twin lead. In other words, ordinary twin lead or open wire transmission line, your left hand wire and your right hand wire have the exact same diameter. And do they do that? Yeah, they do have the same diameter. But using the two lines parallel must obey a set of equations which are called Z odd and Z even. If you fed out of phase signals or in phase signals to those two lines, you measure two apparent impedances. And if you get those Z odd and Z even impedances just right, you then have directivity. The coupling is a function of two things going on. There's capacitance between those two lines, and there is magnetic coupling between the two lines. When you got the ratio of the capacitive coupling and the ratio of the magnetic coupling just right, which is a function of spacing and width of those lines, then you get directivity. So directivity is the right ratio of magnetic coupling and capacitive coupling. So when you go above the frequency, you lose directivity. Is it because the capacitive coupling is wrong? Yes. Is it because the magnetic coupling is wrong? Yes. The ratio between the two doesn't fulfill the requirements anymore. And by the way, you get maximum performance and high directivity when the two lines inside that are parallel are a quarter of a wavelength long. And by way of what I've been telling you, when you go to lower frequencies, where now it's not a quarter wavelength long, it's an eighth wave, tenth wave, twentieth wave, it keeps on working. When you go above quarter wavelength, when you start approaching half wavelength, and beyond that quarter wavelength length, you lose directivity. You lose it because of the wrong length, the wrong ratio of magnetic and capacitive coupling. A lot of things break down. So it works at higher frequencies, just that it doesn't have directivity anymore. And the coupling coefficient also becomes crazy numbers. If you swept the directional coupler, DC to light, and you plot the performance coming out of the coupled port, it would look like a rectified sine wave. You get a whole lot of peaks and valleys as you go up in frequency. You get the first peak when it's a quarter wavelength long internally. You get the first null when it's a half wavelength long. You get the next peak when it's three quarters of a wavelength long. Three quarters of a wavelength long. You get the next valley at a full wavelength long internally. So you get this peculiar lumpy performance, frequency versus amplitude, when you go above, but all of that no longer has directivity. So it's not useless up there, you just can't use it the right way. Having that directivity, being able to, let me drop, using the directional coupler by reversing it end to end on the straight through line, making two separate measurements, you're able to measure what ratio is going forward power on your transmission line versus reflected power on your transmission line. And once you've got those two power ratios, you now have the raw data to measure exact standing wave ratio. So the directivity is very handy. You can still use it as a sampling device at any frequency you want, but now you're not going to have directivity, and the apparent power you measure when there's no directivity is now the sum of forward and reverse in a vector manner. And once you know what it looks like on a normal day, if your transmitter puts out half power, you'll be able to sense that. But to convert it into actual power on the line, you want the directivity in order to be able to find out how much power your transmitter is really putting on that line. KC2WGB, K2RIW, directional couplers are very handy. There's a lot to be learned on them, and very simple passive devices, and I wish the textbooks gave us more of this info. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, yeah, a lot of fun with them, and I've used them above their rated values, but it's only for a reference, and it works well, and you can count on that reference without a doubt. But interpreting it and making it useful for calculations could be difficult, but for monitoring, absolutely no problem. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to my next one. KC2WGB, very good. Here's an interesting question. E equals MC squared. Okay, everybody knows the formula. And here's the question sent in by a gentleman on the chat room. If we pump megawatts into an antenna, does its mass increase? And if not, why? Back to you, Dick.
I'm almost positive the answer is no. Because the power you put into an antenna does not stay there. If everything's working correctly, that power is, from the ham radio operator's point of view, it appears to be immediately radiated into space. There's a little bit of a caveat to that. We know that almost all antennas are standing wave structures. The signal is bouncing back and forth in there 10 times before it finally gets radiated. And so some number of nanoseconds, or maybe even a microsecond downrange, the signal is being radiated into space. But if you're running a megawatt transmitter key down for the next 10 minutes, is all of that 10 megawatts accumulated in the antenna and making it more massive? Absolutely not. That power is continuously being radiated into space. And I guess you could go to the next ridiculous question and find out, if I gather that signal being radiated, is the receiving antenna going up in mass because of the signal you gather? And the answer there is also, again, no. The receiving antenna is gathering that antenna, but the antenna that gathers the receiving signal does not keep the signal in the antenna. It conveys it to the transmission line and sends it down to the receiver. So in both cases, the power doesn't stay there. It's continuously going somewhere else. So equals MC squared, you get a huge ratio of energy versus mass. I mean, 1 gram of mass is almost the amount of power you had in an atomic bomb when you do a complete conversion. So, because of that huge ratio, even though you're running megawatts, the apparent mass there is extremely small. It all stayed in the antenna, but it doesn't stay there. And so, when it comes...
Repeater, timeout.
When it comes to people who are interested in science-like situations, I want to indicate to you guys that there's a series of lectures being given to the public periodically, a couple times per year, at Brookhaven National Laboratory out at Upton, Long Island, in the middle of Suffolk County. And this coming Tuesday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, one of these lectures is being given. A distinguished lecturer, I can't think of the man comes from Berkeley, California, University of California. His name is Hitachi Mayuriana or something like that. He's giving a lecture on the, what's that, the subject matter? It's modern space communication. In other words, modern cosmology is what I can call it. It's a very nice lecture on modern cosmology, starting off at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at Brookhaven National Laboratory. And I'm trying to think of the name of the actual place you go to. In other words, Berkner Hall, B-E-R-K-N-E-R Hall. So when you go through the guard shack at Brookhaven Laboratory, and they ask you where you're going to Berkner Hall to listen to this cosmology lecture that's going to take place 4 o'clock in the afternoon this coming Tuesday, which I guess is October, I think it's October 4th. I went to the lecture at Stony Brook University last Friday night on the subject of gravity wave detection. Very well done lecture. The first Friday of the month, approximately, during the school year. Let me drop. Stony Brook University, throughout the school year, the first Friday of the month, has something called Astronomy Open Night. And so the gravity wave detector had probably 100 or 150 people in that audience Friday night. Very nice lecture with beautiful slides. That's held at the Earth and Space Science Center, lecture hall number 101 in the basement of that building. That lecture hall can hold 300 people, and about 150 people were there last Friday night. That starts off at 7:30 every first Friday of the month. So these free lectures by the two science centers I've mentioned now, Stony Brook University and Brookhaven Lab, they're, in my opinion, worth attending if you're willing to spend the time and go out there to either Stony Brook or Upton. So, good question, and a good science question there, John, but you'd never be able to measure it, the weight difference. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Well, this gentleman may have watched a video I was viewing a couple of weeks ago with a professor. I believe he was from Stanford. And he was talking about if we had a box and we had the ability to confine the energy, if we added energy to the box, its weight would increase. And he was going into a lengthy discussion on that, so maybe that's what was the impetus for that question. So, very good. All right, let me let it drop and I'll go on to my next one. Okay, this is a question about shielding. Now, we know a Faraday cage. The question is, with RF, is a ferrous product better for a Faraday cage or a non-ferrous product? And also, within the same question, he's asking about magnetic shielding. Ferrous product or non-ferrous product? So maybe you could give him a little tips on that. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
If I'm trying to build a shielded box or a shielded room, a screen room, at usual RF frequencies, 10 megs, 100 megs, 1,000 megs. The quality of that shielding is a function of the conductivity of the walls of the shielded chamber. So if I could make the shielded chamber out of copper, silver, silver-plated copper, silver-plated aluminum, I'm going to get the best amount of shielding. So making that out of magnetic material has a lower conductivity usually, and therefore I'm going to get less shielding at RF frequencies. Now, let's go down to very low frequencies. As you know, RF energy, when it hits a conductor, like the semiconductor of your coaxial cable, the so-called skin effect takes place. In other words, the top 10,000th of an inch, or 100,000th of an inch, is where the majority of the current flows on that semiconductor of your coax cable. Your semiconductor, in the case of a piece of inch and a half, inch and 5/8 Andrew Heliax, your semiconductor might be 3/8 of an inch or a quarter of an inch or half an inch in diameter. And if you could, if you want to, make it out of solid copper, and you would end up with a very heavy piece of cable, very expensive. Let me drop. But because of the skin effect, only the top 10,000th of an inch of that copper is doing all the work of all the current being conducted of that RF signal. However, it's a 1 over square root of frequency phenomenon. As I go to lower and lower frequencies, the skin depth gets greater and greater. When I get down all the way to, let's say, 60 hertz, if I've got a piece of cable that's got to convey a signal across the chassis of my piece of electronics, and that piece of cable runs close to the power transformer, which is radiating a 60 hertz magnetic field, even though I've used a piece of RG223 double shielded coax cable to convey that signal that must go near the 60 cycle transformer, you think you've got a very well shielded environment. Not at all. That 60 cycle signal, because the skin depth is such a big number when you go all the way down to 60 hertz, the 60 cycle signal is walking right through that shielding of your coax cable. And so your signal on that semiconductor is still going to get a significant amount of hum pickup. I've been there, I've done that, I've seen this happen. So in that particular case, if the shield of the coax cable was magnetic material instead of conducting material, now the magnetic field coming out of that transformer, let me drop it. The magnetic field coming out of that transformer hits your shielded piece of cable, and the magnetic field hits the magnetic material that's the outer conductor, and the magnetic field is shunted around the semiconductor, never goes through it, and now you're going to get better shielding. So at 60 hertz, magnetic material does a hell of a lot better shielding. Conversely, if I'm trying to build a cage around my transformer, I've got a poorly designed transformer, which has a significant amount of magnetic field coming out of it, and it's disturbing all my nearby circuits inside of that spectrum analyzer, per se. I've been there, done that. And so, you think you could build a six-sided copper box around that transformer and stop it from radiating 60-cycle magnetic field. You go through that heroic effort, and you'll be very disappointed. The amount of 60-cycle magnetic field coming out of that six-sided copper box with all the corners very well soldered or folded over and bent, if you know what I mean, you'd be amazed how much magnetic field would still come out of it. However, if you use mu metal, highly magnetic material, to build the shield around that transformer, now you would get a hell of a lot of shielding. So, should you use copper, conductive material, or magnetic material? The answer is yes, depending on what frequency you're doing it at and what you're trying to remove. So at RF frequencies, conduction counts. At very low frequencies, magnetic counts. KC2WGB, K2IW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yep, okay, very good. Answered that question. It's an interesting fact that when you use a ferrous product to shield, the magnetic element coming from the transmitting portion of whatever it is creates a circulating current in that ferrous product, which is, I believe, more intense and more energy absorption than it would be with a copper product, from what I understand. But, okay, all right, let me let it drop. We'll go on to the next question.
Yeah, stand by a minute here, John. That new metal material conducts the magnetic field around the thing that you're shielding. It's not absorbing the magnetic field. It's conducting it. I mean, by the same token, the copper that's in the outer conductor of your coaxial cable is giving you some beautiful shielding. It's not absorbing the energy that hits it. It's conducting that energy. It's presenting a short circuit to it, so to speak, and conducting it downrange. So, mu metal doesn't absorb magnetic field. It shunts the magnetic field to some other place. So, it's a transmission line to magnetic field. When you're using mu metal under normal conditions, it doesn't run hot. It's not absorbing that magnetic energy. It's conducting it to some other place. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the deck net.
WB2HWW with a comment from that caller.
Circulating currents, and we have resistance there, so the ferrous products do get warm from magnetic coupling. The mu metal, I don't know much about that, so there I'm not sure. But I know they do use mu metal on some of these transformers and to protect the circuits surrounding.
So with real intense magnetic fields, you will get some heating. So not all of it is pure conduction. By the same token, if I run lots of kilowatts through my coax cable, that outer conductor, which is primarily a conductor, will sometimes get hot. It's got a little bit of a low tangent to it. We've got somebody on Echolink who's giving us very heavy modulation, wants to give us a comment. Go right ahead to identify yourself with call letters and name and proceed. K2RIW listening.
WB2HWW, you copy?
Yes, I do, HWW. Your audio is quite heavy. Back off from the mic a little bit and give us your information.
All right, Dick, this is Howard. All right, Dick, this is Howard. I backed away from this iPhone. I'm on that call. Dick, the comment that I want to make, you have those issues when you're using a period resident power supply, and sometimes you have to use balance lines. They're very hard to shield. So if you have something like a period resident supply in a repeater cabinet, the only way to really solve that problem is distance. You know, I think the square of the distance, if you get farther away, you get less hum. So you have to sometimes even shield the cable won't solve it. Sometimes you have to use a balanced audio line. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, WB2HWW.
Yeah, very fine, Howard. I'm glad you put this to our attention. So the line that's got to go near a transformer that's got a strong magnetic field, like some of these ferro resonant, so-called constant voltage transformers, they've got a very strong magnetic field in them. Moving the line as far away from the transformer as possible, that'll help you with shielding. The next step, very few people will use mu metal as a shield around the cable, so to speak. The next step of shielding is to use thoroughly balanced twin lead. If your signal is being sent in a thoroughly differential manner to two wires that are twisted together, and if the receiver on the other end is a thoroughly differential receiver, an operational amplifier-like device, in that case, even though the magnetic field picked up by your twin lead, the twisted wires going near the transformer, even though the magnetic field picked up could be a huge number, volts, as long as you've got a thoroughly balanced transmitter system into the twin lead and a thoroughly balanced receiver system with a lot of common mode rejection, you can reject all of that hum that was picked up. So there's a lot of situations where differential twin lead, with or without shielding, can do a beautiful job. Cat5 cable uses this phenomenon. Those Cat5 cables sprung through the ceiling of many buildings. Let me drop it. Quite often those cables are routed very near great big power transformers, rotary machinery, compressors, air conditioners, all kinds of magnetic radiating devices. Those Cat 5 cables, each of those four wires inside are twisted pairs, or are they eight wires? They're twisted pairs. I think there's four twisted pairs in there. And as long as you're using those twisted pairs properly, you get some beautiful shielding, even though there is, in most cases, no shield on the outside of that Cat 5 cable. It acts like it's almost perfectly shielded, even though it's going by some very strong magnetic fields. So there's a lot to be said with thoroughly differential twin lead feeding of sensitive signals. And thank you for bringing that to our attention, Howie. KC2WGB, K2LIW. You got it, John.
Very good. KC2WGB. All right, we've covered that. Now, on to this one. I'll have to give you the construct and ask you the question. All right, so let me let it drop. Okay, this gentleman wants to know, if we have a transmitter at a fixed point and there's no multipath involved, and we have a reflective structure, water tower, whatever, and we are now receiving a distance away at a receiver, which will remain fixed, and let's say we have a particular number of microvolts at that receiver. His question is, if we take this reflective surface and now it becomes resonant, will it absorb energy and will we see that on the microvolt meter? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's a fun question, which gets into RCS measurements, radar cross section. Let's assume that I've got a transmitter in the first valley, and then the signal I want it to go over the mountain and go into a second valley. So those two transmitters, that transmitter and the receiver in those two separate valleys, are very well isolated from each other. If on the top of the mountain I put a reflecting device, and that's called a, I'm trying to think of the name of this now, it's a periscope-like antenna system, but there's a whole lot of data links where they put up a great big billboard on the top of the mountain. The transmitter in the first valley aims at that billboard, and the signal reflects off the billboard, goes into the second valley. As long as that sheet metal flat reflector on top of the mountain is properly oriented, angle of incident equals angle of reflection, in that particular case, you'll get a beautiful signal going between those two valleys. It's a passive repeater system, that's what it's called. You don't have to give it any power. Just make sure that the reflector stays conductive, stays flat, stays properly oriented, and for years on end, you've got a beautiful connection between those two two sites. The transmitter and receiver can be transmitting and receiving in both valleys, back and forth, through this passive repeater. And now, if you made that sheet metal the right dimensions so that it hits resonance, it wouldn't matter because it is already a specular reflector. It's acting like a mirror. Angle of incidence equals angle of reflection. You get a certain amount of radar cross-section when it's properly oriented. Let me drop.
Repeater, time out.
That's interesting. I timed out the repeater when I wasn't even transmitting. The timer is a little bit crazy. Okay, now if I've got a small reflector up there, too small to really do a good job, and it's not properly oriented, angle of incidence doesn't equal angle of reflection, you still are scattering signal from it between valley A and valley B. You'll still get a signal. It'll be a much weaker signal. It's the wrong size, not properly oriented. If I now slowly make that reflector, that's too small, a resonant length, all of a sudden I'm going to get a much stronger signal. That's the phenomena of frequency selective surface, radar cross section. If you look at the